Morning, everyone. Please pray with me. Oh, Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, beloved Jesus Christ, Blessed Master, Saints and sages of all religions, I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple. Make my heart thy altar. Make my love thy home. Be thou the only king. Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. This evening we'd have a little different format. I wrote a letter in response to someone who asked about some opinions that I expressed about the United States involvement in the after September 11th of last year. And I've been several months in the making of a response of a letter I'm going to read to you this evening. And it's on the role of ahimsa. Don't envision it so much as a political discussion, but the role of ahimsa, which is oftentimes interpreted as nonviolence. So I'll read the letter, and then what I would like is your ideas, your thoughts on the matter. You ask about the role of war. Is violence ever justified in the world? I say yes. There are times when force, even killing another, is justified and appropriate. I'm aware that there are those who would differ from this opinion. So while I set out here to explain in what way force is justified. In this person's letter written to me, they quoted Thich Nhat Hanh saying, "All violence is injustice." So that's part of the context. You referred to the Buddhist teachings of ahimsa, often referred to as nonviolence. It is an ancient concept that has its roots in the Vedas and was enunciated by the Buddha and Patanjali in his Yoga Sutras as well. In recent times, it was taught by Mohandas Gandhi in his nonviolent movement that resulted in India's independence from England. This is a great, noble, and positive ideal for all those following the path of realization. The ancient Vedic teachings, the Jains and the Buddhists, all held ahimsa to be the noblest of ideals, and that it needed to be a part of the basis for a spiritual life. Himsa means harm. A means no or not. Ahimsa means to do no harm. When Yogananda started to swat a mosquito, Sri Yukteswar saw that he saw him withhold the fatal blow. He asked Yogananda why he had not finished the job. Yogananda said he was following the injunction of Patanjali and would not kill a creature. Sri Yukteswar commented that the teaching meant to remove even the thought of harming another. Since Yogananda had made the intent in his mind to kill the mosquito, he had already perpetrated the act. What is needed is to remove even the desire to harm another. This is a very strict and exacting standard indeed. To properly understand ahimsa, we must look closely into it. The desire to do harm can be separated from an act of violence when the focus is put on to the intention. One may ask, is this not parsing out of words? Can you do violence and not intend harm? I would say yes, you can, but it takes great integrity and self-awareness. I will give some examples. Let us take a familiar but less intense example. If a parent was to give out some form of punishment, say a timeout period, can you say that the parent is doing no harm? That would depend on the mindset of the parent. If the parent is angry and acting out from anger, the intent of a timeout will be to inflict some form of pain on the child. The form of timeout may then be locking a child into a closet for a prolonged period of time. The pain created by the punishment may have no connection in the parent's intention to do good for the child. It is simply a primitive response of the parent. For another parent, the intent may be clearly connected to the cause and effect teaching the timeout may have for the child. Therefore, the act is clearly for the good of the child. It is not designed to only inflict pain on the child. The child is sent to their room for a prescribed period of time. Motivation then becomes the criteria for assessing the intention of harm or no harm from the action. Another familiar situation can be used. A husband or a wife becomes angry at their spouse. As a result, they do not talk to each other. The motivation may be that by not talking to their spouse, the silent treatment, they will cause their spouse discomfort, pain. The intention of the action is to create pain and harm to the other. Another possible motivation for not talking may be for the husband or wife does not believe their spouse will take their situation with enough gravity unless the message of silence punctuates the response. Or silence allows for a cooling off period for both, so a constructive conversation may follow. In this case, the desire is not to do harm, but to bring forth mutual understanding. Now let us take a more intense situation. A policeman or woman responds to a call regarding domestic violence. He enters the household and the husband is threatening, posturing, and showing signs of being violent. The policeman assesses the scene and decides the only way to control the situation is to restrain the husband. Police are trained to do this in a way that produces the least amount of harm. Their motivation is to, 1, prevent further harm to the wife, 2, prevent harm to the police on the scene, 3, prevent harm that may occur to neighbors or others in the community, 4, prevent harm to the husband as a result of further angry actions, probably in about that order of importance. The police may act with professionalism, assess the situation, and act to reduce the likelihood of further harm from occurring in that situation. The police may also act without professionalism. They may react out of emotion or mental imbalance that will result in desiring to do harm to the violent husband, and this will result in police brutality. Of course, this is of great concern to all, and there are legal limits to what police can do for this reason. If the police overstep the bounds of what they are allowed to do, they become subject to legal action. This kind of check and balance is what we expect of a civilized society, where justice is not done out of malice, unbridled anger, or desire for revenge, but from a reasoned action of what will be for the highest good for all. Each society and religion has made decisions on what are called reasonable actions, to be taken by those acting in a lawful way. In India, that law is called Dharma. Dharma means the righteous way, the way that corresponds to what is good for all. Now, that is very difficult to codify, as various situations will dictate different responses. Also, it is difficult to read the heart of another, to know what their intentions are, for good or to do harm. This code to do no harm applies to individuals, organizations, communities, and nations. The code of behavior prescribed for each of these reflects the law of cause and effect. As you sow, so shall you reap. This law is exacting and applies to all. Those who live a life of violence, inwardly or outwardly, will live by the consequences of their actions. Those consequences will happen as surely as one who shouts into a canyon will hear his echo. In the action or non-action, is the action or non-action motivated by the desire to do harm, or is their action motivated by what is for the greater good of all? This is the question one must answer to go to the heart of the issue. Take the case of our unfortunate spousal abuser. Being subdued, he is restricted from taking any further action that would result in causing him further karmic harm, causing further harm to his spouse or perhaps the police, neighbors, etc. Perhaps a cooling off period will help him rethink how he's dealing with his wife and create an opportunity for a change of attitude. Whatever the long-term outcome, he is helped in the moment by being restrained. Of course, if you were to ask him at the time of being restrained, if he is unlikely to agree that the police are helping him. Let us take the case of someone who plans even more violent mischief. Mother posed this question to our group one night. If someone was about to set off a bomb that would kill a hundred people, and the only way to stop him is to kill him, what would you do? A few people answered, and then she turned to me and asked, David, what would you do? I said, I would ask God. She said, no time for that. You have to act. I said that I would kill the man and take whatever karmic consequences resulted from the action. Mother said, in that case, there would be no karmic consequences. There may be times when an individual is called upon to protect themselves or others by taking violent action. Police and the military are occasionally called upon to do this. If these actions are done judiciously, that is, without intent, that is, with the intent for the highest good of all concerned, then it results in a positive action. One must know the intent of the leaders and those performing the actions to assess the purity of an act. Thus, in any particular field of action, there may be those on both sides who act with such purity of motivation that they act without thought of doing harm, even though they are committing violent acts. The reason is they are acting with the intent that their action be for the highest good of all. In the story of the Mahabharata, a great epic poem from India, a war is coming. Krishna, as a king, tries to mediate a non-violent solution to the problem. King Duryodhana promised to return the kingdom to the Pandava brothers after a period of exile. The kingdom was not returned to them as promised. As mediator, Krishna asked if 5 villages would be given to the 5 Pandava brothers. They would accept that in lieu of their kingdoms. Duryodhana said that the land, not even the size of a pin, would be given to them. Some of the Pandavas said they felt inclined not to fight and asked the advice of Krishna. Krishna advised them to fight, not only for their own sake, but if an injustice is allowed to go forward, worse things will occur for the kingdom than the original wrong action. Krishna's advice reminds me of when Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia and Poland without any of its allies coming to their defense. It resulted in perpetuating a greater war, a far more costly to all. When I was a child, bullies seemed to be present for most of my growing up years. They practiced intimidation to smaller kids after school when they were walking home. They were also threatening during school hours, but did not usually go so far when teachers were present. Even if they did get into trouble with the teachers, they did not seem to mind. They were a terror to many. Once, while walking home from junior high school, I saw a friend of mine with a cast on his broken arm being spun around by a group of 3 or 4 bullies who did such things daily. The leader was taunting Gary, who was a studious young man with whom I shared an interest in physics. I walked up to the leader and swung my gym bag as hard as I could and hit him in the crotch. I took Gary by the arm and said, "Let's get out of here." The boy I hit picked himself off the ground and started to take the rings off his fingers, a sign that he was ready to fight me. I continue to walk with Gary and we are able to leave the scene. There are times when actions must be taken. The acts of September 11th were an assault on innocent people whose only crime was to go to work that day. It was an enormous act of violence. For instance, it was the single largest loss of British citizens from an act of terrorism in its history. Osama bin Laden's intention was to inflict loss of life on non-combatant citizens, instill widespread fear, and hopefully bring about the collapse of the Western world. Previous acts of violence had been traced to the same individual. Future plans of violence were also known. It is the duty of a leader of a country to protect the people of his country from unwarranted violence. It was the duty of President Bush to protect the citizens of the United States. Afghanistan harbored and supported the person, the aims, and the ideals of Osama bin Laden. The president asked them not to support this terrorist and turn him over to the United States. They refused, and therefore they were complicit with the acts of violence and his future acts of violence. I do not see any other choice for the president to act other than he did. In fact, he would have been negligent in his duty if he did not take those actions. In this regard, I think it pertinent what Swami Ram Dass taught. He said that for a monk, a renunciant, no objection should be made if someone were to take all his possessions. The renunciant should willingly, even gladly, turn over all his possessions, for the renunciant does not see them as his, but God's. But for the householder, a different standard applies. Because the householder has the responsibility of the household, their children, care for elder parents, etc., the householder should defend his property for their sake. This dual standard takes into account the different responsibilities shouldered by the householder versus the renunciant. Were President Bush's acts meant to create harm or to prevent harm? I believe he made a case that his actions were intended to be for the greater good of all. Were there acts of violence against the people of Afghanistan? Yes, of course there were. Were those acts meant to do an ultimate good? Yes, I think that case was made. Would Osama bin Laden and others helping him ultimately be helped by the war made on them? Yes, I think they will be helped, for they would surely accrue more karma for their future destructive acts. In the scriptures of the world, we have interesting contrasts of how God-men act in the world. The Buddha is said to have laid down his life as an offering of food when, as a wandering mendicant, he came upon a starving tiger and her cubs. This act fully prepared him for the tremendous life he was to have when we came to know him as the Buddha, the Awakened One. He taught such wonderful compassion and love for the world. Indeed, his heart was soft and pure, a living embodiment of those very virtues. Jesus, known as the Christ, was also an example of one who laid down his life for his fellow man. Such living examples are emblazoned in our minds. In the Ramayana, we learn of another incarnation of God, an avatar, Rama. He was born to slay the evil Rakshasa, Ravana. Rama was a king, exiled. His wife was abducted by Ravana, all so that he would complete the task he came to do. Krishna, too, came to help the world by killing some evil ones and guiding the Pandavas through a war. The Christ and Buddha stand out as examples of laying one's life down for another. Krishna and Rama teach us there are times when wrongdoers must be put down for the sake of Dharma, righteousness. Different tools of action based on what is needed in the moment. To correctly understand what creates harm and what prevents harm, one must understand the totality of the situation. This knowledge can only be known by going beyond the appearance of good and evil and intuitively perceiving the right action. Ahimsa, then, is not correctly translated as nonviolence. Non-harm and nonviolence are not always synonymous. Gandhi, the great advocate of nonviolence, put himself in an interesting position by fasting for political reasons. When Gandhi fasted, he did so to persuade others to make agreements and to stop the violence that was currently erupting. The first thing that may be said about fasting until death, it is violence against the body. The internal organs shut down, the body eats itself, and eventually dies. Gandhi came close to creating this ultimate condition in his body. A second point about his fasts. One may ask, why were his fasts so effective? The reason was simple. If Gandhi died, and not everyone cared whether he lived or died, but if he died, everyone knew violence would erupt in the streets. The Muslims in particular knew that, as a minority population, they would be at great risk. The pressure on both sides was immense to make an agreement in order to avoid full-scale war in the streets. Now, I think if we looked in the heart of the Mahatma, we would see his intention for doing the fast was for the greater good of all. But the fact he was doing violence to his own body and his own death carried the threat of greater violence cannot be avoided. His vow of nonviolence was being broken, but his vow of ahimsa, doing no harm, by doing actions for the greater good of all, was immaculately kept. In this world of duality, warfare continues around us at all times. Life feeds upon death. Death is required for life to be sustained. There may be evolutionary ages when the world will live by more refined laws, but at the present, this is the truth. Our beloved ancient forests actually reside on ground that is nearly sterile. The nutrition has been leached from the ground by the earlier growth of trees. If it were not for the death of the older trees, the newer trees would have no nutrition to make them live. Animals, insects, and all of nature feed upon some form of death or another. For the compassionate heart, these facts are harsh realities indeed. I am watching a bird of prey just now, a cooper's hawk. The hawk is circling and swooping over the freshly mowed field looking for some rodent or serpent for supper. The sun is lowering itself into the horizon. It is so soft and quiet out. What does a compassionate heart do? Do I cheer the hawk on, moving as silent as the breeze, hopeful to pounce on its dinner? Do I warn the mice and the snakes of the danger overhead? I find it is not easy to choose one over the other in this deadly game, and it continues daily. The teaching of ahimsa has a noble and long tradition. Some Jains sweep the road in front of them and strain all the water they drink to avoid killing any insects. There are those adherents who will starve their bodies to death in their desire to do no harm and to gain enlightenment. One may go to great lengths to avoid doing harm. But if in trying to avoid one harm, by following a rigid philosophy, one allows a greater harm to occur, then has not the principle been violated? People of principle can disagree, even while agreeing on the principle. Certainly, as the spiritual aspirants, we are all called upon to continually strive to do what we can for the highest good of all. Knowing what will enact that good is not always easily known. But if we delve deep into ourself, residing in stillness, and openly asking the question, then the way is shown for each situation. A surgeon may lovingly commit trauma against the body by cutting it open in an attempt to help the body. Desire to heal motivates his action, even though his action is a violence against the body. Ahimsa is the purification of the mind and heart so that compassion and love will underlie all our actions. Ahimsa is the purification of our mind and heart so that compassion and love will underlie all our actions. Certainly the United States is not the policeman of the world, nor should they try to be. But nations have the right and the duty to protect innocent citizens from harm. Every effort should be made to do this without violence, without hatred, without prejudice. Even as the policeman is expected to act within the province of rules, dharma, so should nations and individuals. Situations may demand action that includes violence in order to prevent greater harm. May we all be blessed, individually and collectively, to be guided by the light of right understanding, so ahimsa may shine through the actions of all. So I think that this topic is an interesting one, and one that may not and surely would not have consensus amongst all spiritual aspirants in thinking about applying ahimsa, doing no harm. So I thought it would be enlightening, perhaps, and interesting for me to hear your thoughts on the issue. And again, not so much from a political standpoint, but from the philosophical standpoint, the spiritual standpoint, of the role of nonviolence, the role of not doing harm. Do you think that it's possible to adhere to ahimsa and to take an action that may injure another, may kill another? Is that possible? Or is that too much of a stretch?
Human life is a sacred thing. And your life or the life of those you love is more sacred than the life of someone that's trying to damage you or them. Mm-hmm. If you got to make a choice, that's the choice. Mm-hmm. And that, again, the motivation is not malice. Mm-hmm. So there is no conflict in this philosophically that I perceive it. Mm-hmm. I read within the last week or so, I think, Gandhi was quoted as saying that sometimes it may be necessary to kill someone who's trying to harm you. I can't remember what issue the paper that was in or who the columnist was even, but that was interesting. I had never read that before.
That is interesting. I think, and he came from a family of strict Jains. Jains are some of the ones who adhere to the idea of nonviolence as strictly or more strictly than any other sect that I know of.
It seems to me too that philosophically, that the concept the sages expound of nonviolence, no violence, period. Mm-hmm. May be a holdover from an earlier, brighter evolutionary age in human history. But right now, here's where we're at. Mm-hmm. We're not that far out of the dark ages. Mm-hmm. And we do have to protect ourselves if it's necessary. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I think the related point is the one that I tried to make in this writing, which is, if greater violence, greater wrongs accrue from not acting, then you've participated in helping to perpetuate them. In other words, the Pandavas, for instance, in the Mahabharata story, if they had not fought to take back their kingdom and Duryodhana was allowed to retain it, then that would give him a green light to continue those kinds of actions. May have launched wars against other peoples and, you know, on down the line.
Oh, yeah.
Osama bin Laden and somebody in our current day, I think, without any doubt, whether you agree or disagree with his views, his intention was to continue his role of violence and escalating violence in the world. And to not take action would be to open the door to more of that happening. And you have a right and a duty to protect yourself, and I think you do. And I think the president certainly is specifically charged with that. So a country has a right to protect themselves.
Yes. This example of somebody threatening to set off a bomb in a large crowd. If you don't drop the guy, thou shalt not kill, right? If you don't drop this guy when you had the opportunity, you're going to take on the karma for 100 or 200 innocent people's lives in that crowd.
Mm-hmm. I think so. At least you take on some portion. And that's a difficult call, especially if you are trying to lead a spiritual life.
Well, that's why it's important, I think, to bring out this balance that you expressed in that mm-hmm. letter. Mother talked to me about this one time years ago, using this example of a guy threatening to set off a bomb down at the airport, for example, uh-huh. of course. And I hadn't even thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I related this. There was this young lady who was a secretary where I worked years ago, and she was a real-life religious person, and I related this story to her, and I said, what would you do?
Mm-hmm.
She said, well, I'd have to pray about it. I said, you probably ought to start doing it now, so you know what you're
going to
do.
His mother said, there's no time, you have to act.
That's right.
Yeah.
That just blew her socks off.
Well, I think a true pacifist says that if that man's going to drop the bomb, of course that you can't do anything, because if you're going to be true to your pacifism, and whatever happens, happens. And I remember at one point when I was young, really thinking that I believed that, and I think as you get older, or you have family or whatever, that starts to become, for me, it started becoming less realistic and less something that I would want to do, that I felt like I would want to protect those innocent people instead of save the life of that person that was going to do the harm. And,
your perspective enlarges with time.
There's a naivety around the notion that there are simple rules that would just enact us. If everyone just lived according to these simple rules, everything would be simple.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't need many complex.
Mm-hmm.
These examples brought up by mother and people like that, all the people who are involved with being close to being bombing, you have dharmic, karmic reasons for being there, etc., are just kind of a sophistry around trying to get complex.
Well, I think there's Thich Nhat Hanh, who I quoted. He was a Buddhist monk in Vietnam during the Vietnamese War, so I don't think you could say he's in the ivory tower looking down on the world from that safety. He's seen what violence can do.
Lots of people in the Christian and the Buddhist and Hindu tradition that are complete pacifists, the Quakers and the Christian tradition, but
mm-hmm.
Christian tradition seems to have less of that. Seems to believe in just wars and believe in self-defense and believe in things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't Mother say she wouldn't do it?
She wasn't sure if she could. She was talking about that she used to fish, and that she didn't think that she could fish today because she didn't think she could kill the fish, you know, once it was caught. She wasn't sure whether she could do it herself, but she thought it would be the right thing to do.
And to read no karma.
Yeah.
I guess you have to listen to your inner direction when the time comes.
Mm-hmm.
You can think about all you want to ahead of time, and this is good for clarifying your thoughts. When the time comes, you'll do what you feel directed to do, hopefully.
I think you do what you instinctually will do, because I don't think you can even, I don't even know if it's a feel directed. I think it's so instant, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether I would do it or not personally either, whether I could or would, but...
I remember that night when, it was, you know, 30-some years ago, that Mother put that question to me. And I knew in that moment, and there again, you never know unless you're actually doing that. But I felt the certainty, the clarity in my mind that what I would want to do is to take that action and to eliminate that person who was about to kill those innocent people.
Yeah, IMSA is non-harm toward the innocent people.
Mm-hmm.
In that example.
Mm-hmm. And I think to take the violence out of the heart, But there are some people, and I've spoken to some people who were proclaiming a nonviolent kind of creed, and yet they were angry individuals. They were had a lot of rage they were dealing with. And in my mind, they were not calm. They were not good examples inwardly of what they were trying to espouse, how everybody else should act. And I think that there's a paradox there. I think the harder work is to go inside and to eradicate those places of reactivity and anger that would motivate an unjust action or a reaction, so that you could be calm even in the midst of something quite difficult happening, maybe something violent going on, and could you stay calm so that you could listen to that still small voice even in the midst of something terrifically difficult going on.
If you have time, I was talking with an old German guy one time. He'd worked for Wernher von Braun in World War II. And he said that in the German army, if something came up, you know, not a instant decision type of thing, they would wait 24 hours before they decided what to do. Which kind of makes sense.
I've employed that rule myself for different things.
Don't just count to 10. If you don't have time to, then you just do the best you can.
Another complication coming from Gandhi and showing how he really thought this through and lived it was that he believed that if people chose to be a pacifist for cowardice, for cowardice reasons, that because they're afraid of war, that was worse than being a combatant if you're on the right, just side. Of course, that always goes without saying that you can't even never be on the wrong side of the offender, the offensive side of the actions. But that he felt that the purity of the heart is more important. Therefore, if you're doing it for the wrong reasons, the actions themselves are not as important as the heart. And that's what you're saying too, that you get ahimsa in your own heart. And the Sri Yukteswar says, that's what that's the only way you can be blessing him as you are dying, as Gandhi did.
And what a tremendous example he was of those teachings.
I would love to have heard his reply to the dilemma that we talked about with him, in that there would be more violence on the street if he died, and he was threatening violence by his staff. I know that he would have a studied answer, and probably would still recognize that this world is complicated and that there aren't simple decisions. But he had to, as you said, in the higher understanding of himself.
Nothing is really simple. Niels Bohr, the atomic physicist, said one time, there are two kinds of truths. There are ordinary truths and there are great truths. The opposite of an ordinary truth is a falsehood. The opposite of a great truth is an ordinary truth. An example, thou shalt not kill, and this guy threatened to set off a bomb in a crowd, is a perfect example of that, I think. There are words about words that we can allow to tie our hands and make us take our personal power away from us. Let our intellect get in the way.
Yeah, we don't have Jesus or Buddha in the room to ask them what they might do if faced with certain situations, and is there a time when you could act?
Well, a lot of times, if, say you had the time to ask for help even, and you didn't get an answer, then you have to do what you feel directed inside and do the best you can. And with hindsight, you might do completely differently next time. But you still did the best you could at the time under those circumstances. So
it's interesting to me that the Buddha and Jesus both live lives of renunciance. They're the strongest advocates of absolute nonviolence and turning the other cheek.
Yet anyone.
And Rama and Krishna were both in positions of being rulers over countries. And in both of their examples, we have times and places where they committed violence. In fact, the whole point of their taking an incarnation was to destroy certain evil beings, as the story goes.
Jesus was against violence, but I figure anyone that could take a horse whip to a bunch of bankers to chase them out of the temple can't have been all bad.
Perhaps it comes back down to Arjuna telling Krishna to, you know, that whole idea in the Bhagavad Gita where they talk about caste and talking about knowing yourself and knowing who you are and how you approach God. And mm-hmm. And perhaps if you are a renunciant and you are a person like Gandhi, then it's going against your whole nature and your dharma and your path to commit violence. And mm-hmm. what you would do in that situation, the man's here in the room and he's about to throw the bomb, you would just say Rama, 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 and you'd all die together, and that's your karma to die together mm-hmm. like that. But you would not lift a finger to stop that. And those of us that have a more worldly life, and we are in the world, and we're following the guru that we're following, perhaps it is ours to do something different. And mm-hmm. and what Mother's saying of, well, I'm not sure if I could do it, then perhaps her as a spiritual teacher, even though she's maybe giving us the advice and saying to you, yes, that's the right choice, for her, perhaps if we're where she was at that point, perhaps she wouldn't. Perhaps mm-hmm. she would just allow it to happen and would bless all those in the room and bless the man who's killing them all. And so it's perhaps maybe more being true to oneself, where we're at in our spiritual mm-hmm. life and where we're at in our path.
Mm-hmm. If she had the vision to see that about that group of people, that would be one thing, you know, hypothetically. But I don't have that kind of vision, so I would have to just lower my head and charge, not knowing anything.
Well, that's when I said your instinct, I don't really mean a baser instinct. I mean that there's something inside of you that is who you are and your own character, and when faced with something scary or something, yourself jumps out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we often don't know what we're going to do in situations like that.
Not till it happens.
And I've been surprised a couple times when I've been in a scary situation that I'm very strong and powerful and calm, because my inclination would be that I'd be a complete coward and I'd run and I'd freeze and I'd shake. But I don't really know that, and when it happens, instinctually I act, and just act without almost thinking. And so I think your inner character comes out at that point, and maybe one's character would be to just sit and say, God bless us all. And the other person might act.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You never know.
Certainly, all of Arjuna's life pointed, all of his training, everything was for him to be a kshatriya, a warrior.
Mm-hmm.
Everything in his life pointed to that. If Krishna were speaking to somebody else who was a renunciant monk, he may have had very different mm-hmm. advice. But for him to get to that mm-hmm. junction of having to make a decision, and for him to stand back and say, well, I think I prefer to be a monk now that I'm here on the battlefield.
Gandhi's talking about being the coward, isn't he?
And it wasn't cowardice, which is an interesting thing with him. It was not him being a coward. It was his compassion.
Yeah, I shouldn't have said that.
But that was actually Krishna says, others will think you're a coward.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't the dilemma he was in. It was compassion for true and noble people on the other side. That would...
Well, listen, you know, when you think of what Mother told us in terms of eating animal products,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, when we're at the ashram in India, it's thought of as such a great sin. And I've been trying to think in my mind what I feel about it. I really kind of feel like what Mother has said before, that if you're directed to not eat that meat, then God mm-hmm. will tell you at that time to do it.
Mm-hmm.
part of my thinking is that I don't particularly, just like with your example of the hawk killing the little mouse, it's just the way nature is, and I almost feel like, well, if you're a cow or you're a lamb or you're a chicken, that's your dharma to have somebody eat you.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly we can do raise those animals and kill those mm-hmm. animals without harm.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously we're killing them, but I mean without cruelty. But that just seems like almost the natural order of the world. Is to, I guess that's more the Christian approach, that you're given these things, God gives you all these things on the earth to use for your for humankind.
Certainly the Native Americans would fall into that, and I think many, many other religions as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's, you know, the hawk and the mouse is interesting, because if the hawk doesn't eat the mouse, the hawk dies. So then are you wishing for the death of the hawk? It's, there's, you know, if the tree doesn't fall in the old growth forest, then the new trees die. They don't have enough nutrition.
I guess a lot of vegetarians say, we don't die if we don't eat the meat.
Hmm.
We have other ways of
eating. In that case. But in cases of war, what we're talking about here, where somebody's about to take imminent action, somebody will die.
Yes.
Somebody will die. And there, the higher order of harm comes in if you allow a despot to come in and have his way, and injustice to reign, and death and violence and all the rest of it that can come about because of that. And for instance, if England and France had reacted when Hitler went into Poland and went to Poland, all the greatest number of Jews who were killed in the camps were Polish Jews. Might have that changed the story for them, and it certainly would have if they had done that. You do one action, even though it's an action of violence, in order to prevent greater harm from happening. And in that sense, I think that we can act in accordance with ahimsa. We don't act out of anger. We're not acting out of vengeance. We're acting out of reasoned perspective that says, if I do not act here, greater harm will accrue. And acting here means doing some violence.
I was taking it away from the human examples of that kind of thing and just going into that other part
mm-hmm.
of the ahimsa, which is killing things to eat.
Mm-hmm.
I've read that the Native Americans often would apologize to the spirit of the deer they were going to shoot.
Mm-hmm. Or they would pray to the spirit, thanking it.
Yeah.
For giving itself.
Yeah.
For their own needs.
The other thing that Gandhi said was that God can roll a boulder through a village and kill exactly who he wants.
Hmm.
If we take it upon ourselves to kill that person who's about to roll that boulder down,
mm-hmm.
then we are saying God doesn't know what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's taking God-like power over somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing to acknowledge that there's killing going on just in the world, regardless, just in order for us to breathe, there's amoebas and bacteria being killed right now in our body, etc. But to the extent that we can, and we are omnivorous, we don't have to eat meat to the extent.
Mm-hmm. So then the question comes, can God prompt you to violence? And here we have two examples of avatars, incarnation of God, both committing violence in the form of Krishna and Rama, and which he takes as allegorical completely, and not historical. But if you were to take the historical examples, there are, and if you look at the Old Testament, there are times when God prompts David or others to take violent action.
And Jesus ate meat. You know,
Also, I mean, he could have stopped the crucifixion. I mean, he could have walked. And that was violent.
He could have walked.
His own.
Allowing violence to be done against his own self.
So if God prompts you, you can carry that action out. I think Gandhi was just saying that man can't act with certainty, so therefore he shouldn't act in violent ways. If you can, you know, if you're fully realized, then that's fine.
God could prompt you to nonviolence, but he can't prompt you to violence.
It is simply that he's saying...
Because you choose to be nonviolent as well as violent.
But he's saying if you are fully realized, then you can interpret it as God prompting. If you're not fully realized, then you're not sure if it's God prompting you or your own aim.
Correctly interpret it as God prompting.
Huh?
You can correctly interpret it as God prompting. God may prompt people to do violence, and they don't do it because of his higher, what they consider to be a higher position. And they are in direct opposition to God's own teaching. They do it. But Gandhi is simply saying that that's easier to... if you don't know anything else, that's a simpler and better rule to live by.
But that also, the example is that, say, God, you know, is instructing some man to push a boulder.
Or God does it through an avalanche. Didn't mean to say that. The example with the David had was with the bomb, in which you could kill that person rolling a boulder. The boulder was not necessarily controlled by a man in the first example, but second, that was my second example.
Oh, I was just going to say that if that would have been your example, that somebody was at the top of the hill and he was going to push a boulder down, that could be God prompting him. But also, there would be somebody else standing there saying, "No, I'm not going to let this happen." That could be God prompting him. And it was that person's dharma. Are they going to follow this prompting?
Gandhi only said
stop
that
him.
Those philosophical discussions and the decisions that come from them, it's. If you want to, you know, understand what he was teaching, he was saying that if you don't know what to do, then follow this rule. The rule is you should never create violence if you never have violence. And because it's easy to get so easy to convince yourself that God's prompting you to do something that you'd like to do anyway.
But also,
there were lots of reasons for that.
Gandhi was in the midst of a country where they were like killing each other, over nothing. I mean, they just for the simple fact that they were just out to kill. I mean, he was coming from a place where there was no reason. I mean, people were not reasonable.
But he developed this philosophy and way of his teaching was developed during the time dealing with the British, in which there was not that kind of wholesale slaughter that occurred at partition. So most of the stuff, but he saw physical abuse that was terrible in South Africa and in India both. That was unsustainable. He couldn't defend it, and yet he came up with this philosophy. I hate to call it a philosophy because I think it's higher than a simple philosophy. He's a great proponent of it.
Well, we certainly know that God, people can misinterpret God prompting them to kill because the jihad people right now are doing that. So
it's not God prompting them to kill. It's a bunch of politicians
hijacking the words of religion to brainwash them. They believe it's...
Well, sure, they've been brainwashed.
Oh, yeah, I know that, but I'm saying they would still tell you that
But
God's
that individual
telling,
who has been brainwashed is what you're saying.
Some of you...
They still believe that they're doing God's will.
Oh, sure.
And that is where I think, and Gandhi would agree with this, that it is the purification of the heart and the mind to make them nonviolent, as is the main place of operation, to focus strictly on the act itself and to ignore what's going on in the mind and the heart. That's not real ahimsa or nonviolence. And could he allow, and I don't know if he could or not, because I've not read that of him, could he allow for somebody who's perfectly at peace in their own inner stillness, could they act with violence towards another person? Is that possible?
That's a very good question. That's the state that none of us speaking from saying, no, I don't think so.
I don't know if she is saying that or not.
My memory is that she said that I couldn't do it.
Well, she said personally.
She didn't say that one could not.
No, she supported someone doing it.
Yeah,
she said that there's no karma.
But I don't know that she is saying that somebody in her state of mind, her state of being, she is not a martial soul, or she was not. But if somebody came onto the earth with her state of realization, but it was theirs to carry out some righteous war, that they, I don't think she is saying that wasn't possible.
Absolutely not. You're right. Mm-hmm. She was not saying that. Yeah. She was saying that from that state that she was presently in, she didn't think she would do it.
Mm-hmm.
But yes,
and given
God prompting her to do it very strongly, she would feel and then act.
Mm-hmm.
With regard to the example of, say, you'd see somebody standing up on a hill getting ready to push a boulder down onto a village, and we've said, well, maybe God's prompting him to do this. The thing is, I don't know about the rest of you folks, but I'm not smart enough to know what's prompting him. And I would make a hip shot to save the people down below and assume maybe the guy was just a psycho case or whatever. It'd be, the probabilities would be with it, judging by most of the gratuitous violence that occurs in our culture today.
I think the same thing.
I'd stop him if I had a chance.
I don't think Larry was saying that God was prompting him to throw the boulder. He's just meaning in the sense that everything comes from God, and so therefore it's these people's karma to be run over by a boulder. He wasn't saying that this man says, "Yes, Lord, I will."
Well, I wasn't sure I understood the words that were said. And I thought it crossed my mind.
Mm-hmm.
The point really is that it's not an issue if you have purity of spirit and you have a connection with God.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the point I got from what your letter was, that the point is for me personally, is to work on my own purity of spirit. And
God will guide you in those situations. And even if you don't have time to consciously check back with God, that's where Gandhi's own lifelong practice of residing in that state of consciousness, and for somebody to step in front of him, if you could just imagine somebody stepping in front of you and firing 3 shots inside it, and just the shock of those bullets coming, entering, and the pain, and everything that comes from that, and for him to pronoun Ram, 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 all the way down to the what a magnificent conclusion to really a magnificent life. And if we all follow in those footsteps, whether we choose an absolutely nonviolent life or not, I think we set ourselves a very good and high-minded goal.
It seems to me that the what you mentioned and what you said, Carla, a few minutes ago about finding our own inner purity is a key thing, because we attract what we focus our attention on.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in the armed forces, I sat down and wrote down a list of goals that I wanted to achieve sometime in my life. One of them was a judo black belt. Judo was the martial art back in those days, because the rest of them hadn't really made their way out here, in big time. And then years later, we've been Aikido, which is the king of the martial arts. The only thing is, there's a breathing exercise that's the exact opposite of Kriya. And I talked with Mother about this, and she said, don't. Because, you got things fighting each other, who knows what happens. But it occurred to me in recent years that for some reason, God has been good to me. I've kept out of an awful lot of trouble, although I've been a few places that I wouldn't command to everybody necessarily. But I think, looking back on it, whatever peace I've achieved within myself has been responsible for keeping me out of a lot of trouble. Apparently, by and large, I just haven't drawn a lot of stuff that could have come by.
Mm-hmm.
And I thank God for the blessing.
Well, I think that's certainly true, in that if we are giving out light and peace and purity ourselves, we don't attract those situations and we seem to be able to stay out of them. But I think the other issue you're approaching, David, in writing this letter to her, is how do we see the world?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we... there's one thing that we might ourselves, in being in a spiritual path, and probably not too often in situations where we're having to fight or defend or anything else, but how do we look on the world, and how do we look on what the president is doing and what the country should do? And I mean, he is in a different position than the rest of us. his dharma has been to be a president, and he has duties and things that he has to do that we don't have to do, and we can stay out of, and we can say, you know, I just want to be a pacifist, but we still have to have a feeling for what he should be doing and what the country should be doing in our name. And that's a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a little bit different. It's because we can, although I guess, you know, what one wants for oneself in terms of that peace and the serenity and the purity, we can hope for our country,
mm-hmm.
that our country will act from that position too.
Mm-hmm.
There's a mass karma for any country, any group of people. Not everyone in any particular group are saints.
Mm-hmm. But we're part of this group, you know, of this country. And so, what say we? You know, is there a time for a righteous war? Is there a time for a righteous action in that sense?
Yep.
And as my response was, initially in the letter, was yes, there is.
And there, again, it's back to what is this individual or country's dharma. You know, if we are a little New Zealand,
mm-hmm.
we were New Zealanders, we can say, you know, well, I think we should just all be peaceful. But in this country, it seems to be the dharma of this country to lead the world and to defend freedom and to do. And so we, as people living here, have a part of that, don't we? That's part of our dharma.
If New Zealand chooses not to act, probably no great harm will come from the world. But if the United States chooses not to act, I think the potential for great harm is there.
And the fact that we are citizens of this country means that we somehow share that.
We are part of that.
That
obligation.
Obligation and dharma,
mm-hmm.
and
responsibility.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, God would have put us somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we have to know how to look at our country and how to regard these things.
Mm-hmm. I don't think we could afford to do like some of the European countries and sit back and talk and expound and preach from a lofty stance and do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes doing nothing is the worst possible thing you can do.
Mm-hmm.
You have nothing against the European.
Well, we're facing a situation now with Iraq, aren't we? Where maybe people who have more information than I have, but there's some thought that they could develop nuclear weapons.
Oh, yeah.
And working on delivery systems, and do you wait until they do that, or do you do something before they do that? And the cost for doing it after they develop it is somewhat higher.
That can get pretty spendy.
Yeah. So it's very pertinent to us, and as spiritual people, and as spiritual beings, of course we pray for this world, but there is this practical kind of application. What do we support? What do we say? Each one of us, I think, are accountable for that.
At one time, people used to pray for the country and pray for their president.
Mm-hmm.
It's really actually something we should all be doing, and for the whole of the leaders, that they do what is the holy way.
Yes.
Know, they do
that they be guided. Yeah. They be guided.
We have this one president said, he prayed before making important decisions, and then somebody said, yeah, the whole country prayed afterwards.
It's a tough job. Any other thoughts on ahimsa?
The holy rock thing bothers me.
The what? Oh,
the holy rock thing bothers me because I'm not sure that we're being given the straight scoop. I don't know what to believe and what not to believe about what they say. This guy that was the head of the UN inspection team finally bailed out. I can't remember his name. And he said they do not have this capability anymore.
Hmm.
And his thought is that some of this saber rattling, if you will, maybe is not appropriately placed.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what to believe.
Like I said, I don't particularly want to make it a political conversation.
No.
But in principle, if somebody were to develop weapons like that, and the price for non-action could be quite high with somebody with a leader like that, who would be, I think, probably willing to use weapons such as that, and certainly threatened to use them.
He demonstrated the willingness to use mm-hmm. it against his own people.
Yeah.
If that really was what was going on,
yeah,
his SWAT fly before it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, some years back, Iraq had a nuclear reactor. Israel wouldn't destroy it.
Mm-hmm.
And other countries condemned them outwardly, publicly, but privately, they said, thank God somebody took them.
Yeah.
A lot of big sighs of relief.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. And if that was for real, how come they didn't finish the 1991 war? Well, they were all tooled up to do it.
I don't think they've had the capability, but they've certainly worked on it.
Yeah.
They'd love to have it.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Let's focus on this world. God showed me a beautiful vision one time about how we've heard and read about something not so beautiful, which is in a crowd, how fear can take over. A crowd is stampeded. It just sweeps across the crowd and people panic and large movements of people begin and people are oftentimes hurt and other travesties happen. In the same way, light and upliftment can sweep over a group of people or over this entire world like a wave. And suddenly people's mood changes, their minds calm, their emotions grow more steady. They might look back just even how they were acting recently and wonder at themselves why or how they could ever think or act in that way. That this kind of change can happen suddenly, even radically, where a wave of light sweeps around this world, changes the hearts, minds, attitudes of people. If we could see such a wave, send the power of God that is within us that has no limit, and see that wave sweeping across this world, all around it, all through it, penetrating into the hearts and the minds of even the most hardened hearts, even the minds that are most bent on cruelty and anger, an awakening in all people, in all places, the divine nature that resides within them innately, positively. A nature that cannot be killed, cannot be drowned, cannot be burned, cannot be destroyed even by the individual soul themselves. And see that light of love, of peace, of uplifting thoughts, sweeping around this world. Would anybody like to add their own thoughts or prayer for this world?
the decision from President Bush that it's the highest good for all concerned. Prayers that follow the righteous way.
And the prayer that all those that practice a religion will start to see the universal light in all religions and realize the unifying oneness of God.
May this world see peace and light and love and harmony. I'd like to see it happen in my lifetime if it's possible.
Send out healing arms.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence.
Are radiant with thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with thee.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.